how many people are, you know, in terms of numbers, can you give us a handle on the quite a few of the last when people go through that thing in Seattle? And,
yes. Yes, the Alzheimer's program.
How long?
Those that can afford it. And like I say, the cost is $3,600.
How long has it been in existence?
Since 70? 69, 70, something like that. I'd have to look at my records.
When you say a lot of Alaskans, is that, you know, like a dozen or more, or a couple hundred? Or?
And during the year, I referred 50 down there last year. And while I was down there, last month there was 12 Alaskans from all over the state, I think 6 from Anchorage, a couple from Ketchikan and Sitka.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll certainly take a look at that. Who would like to be next? Well, we're open. Anybody who, these two gentlemen don't wish to speak.
I have one comment. That program is talking about alcohol advertising.
Would you give us your name?
Too? My name.
Thank you.
The alcohol program you mentioned down in Washington, they're advertising the radio. So their business looks pretty good up here to advertise a spot to work. My concern, as a citizen of Alaska, I think we're going to different class citizenship with our minority studies, our poverty studies, the court system. If you have no money, you can have a free lawyer. If you have a moderate amount of money, if you may go broke hiring a lawyer, you have to hire a lawyer and go broke. But if you don't have the money, you have a free lawyer. If you have lots of money, you can afford a lawyer. But you have a first class, second class, third class citizenship, right? The way I see it. I think as a citizen, we should all be considered equal. And if we want to use the public defender, it should be made available, regardless of your income, regardless of your nationality, regardless of your height or your weight or your color. I think if you want that service, just like using a mail, it should be made available, like the canon education. My next comment I'd like to make is on the judges. I think the judges should be elected by the people. I feel the judges represent the people's wishes of the community, of the state. And the people should be concerned directly with that process. Those are the only two comments I have on.
Yes, Chair.
Mr. Cutton. Yeah, I get myself in trouble here. you know, I really appreciate your comments on the legal services. You know, whether or not they're available to all people, and it's, you know, as legal help isn't the only area like that. I know that if you work for the government or if you're either high income or low income, you have good opportunity for free medical or at least some sort of insurance coverage. But the I don't know whether it's a majority or not, but a lot of people that are private citizens in the private sector as far as employment and so forth don't necessarily enjoy those benefits. And that's why, you know, there's a lot of, in some areas, a lot of support for national health insurance. And I think that some of the arguments that have been used to promote that theory, and that, you know, there is that segment of the population that doesn't get it. Everybody else does. I think it's probably the minority that doesn't have access to reasonable medical insurance, reasonable medical health. I think that you're right. You know, a lot of those same arguments could be used for access to legal health. And I think that probably the theory behind the free legal is that just like what the judge tells you, anybody that goes before a court, well, if you can't afford a lawyer, you aren't going to be denied the opportunity to have legal help. But you made a pretty striking point there. In
this gentleman,
sure.
In this case.
So I think you made some real hit-home type comments in that regard. And on the judges, I think that we've had some correspondence on that. And just because I don't agree with you, I think that, you know, I'm finding out that more and more people feel that way, and it's not a matter of whether a legislator agrees with you or not, because if it ever came to it, I'd have one vote, you'd have one vote, so that's really not much from do either. It's much good to argue about the merits of it. But I think the question is whether or not people should have the right to vote on it. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. Martin?
Thank you. When you elect the judges, I agree with you in part. I do have a bill right now in the hopper for the election of these Supreme Court judges. How far would you go with the election of these judges? From all of them, before you think that they're all judges?
I would get the people.
Well, yeah, the company that legislated it would be one that could do all judges.
I think all judges. But the only thing is that Supreme Court, their term would be different than the district and the Superior Court term. Mm-hmm.
Is there on a regular basis, 6 years, 10 years?
Depends on the court. Just for, say, 6 years district, 12 years Superior, and last time Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Or to a maximum age. That's just my idea. I mean,
Mr. Chairman, is it Hyman? Mr. Hyman, what is your? Do you find some faults in the present system, or do you just think the other one would be better because the people would be choosing? Or do you have some actual, complaints about the way it works now?
I think it'd be better government, mm-hmm, if the people could vote directly for their who's going to govern.
I'm assuming that you also favor the election of the AG and the Attorney General in the state, too. Is that right?
Getting back to your earlier point on the different classes of citizens and as far as legal assistance is concerned, it is a problem. I don't really know what the answer is because, this determination of whether you get legal help or not, a judge, you fill out these forms and the judge looks at this and says you are or not entitled to it. And of course you might be, in his determination, able to pay for an attorney, but you might have to do what Mr. Jim O'Connor said, which is something, mortgage your house or sell your car or whatever in order to do it, which is a pretty rough way to go. And on the other hand, if we would make it available to everybody, I really don't know. What we do with lawyers, we seem to have an awful lot of lawyers on the state now. We have more.
On a per capita basis, New York and Washington, D.C. have more lawyers than anybody else.
But we're third.
We're third overall.
Yeah. Okay, if you don't have anything else, Mr. Heidlin, and that's when maybe this gentleman back here, or did you want to go first, sir? Either way. We don't. Pardon?
Well, now we have more complaints than anything. I'm concerned about various drug bills.
Okay. Could you give us your name, please?
Gail Dial.
I'm sorry.
Gail Dial.
Dial. Okay. Ms. Dial, what is your question?
Well, I'm wondering what way the police officers when they present how does it compare to yours and the one Hammond system?
Hammond came in about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Well, I can't.
There's obviously something that somebody feels is wrong with the police officer's bill.
Well, I won't speak to anybody else except me now, right? And I'm not speaking for the committee because this is my bill that I think we asked about. And I won't speak to Governor Hammond's latest thing that was in the papers because I haven't ever seen it. I've just seen what was in the newspapers about his bill, and I have no idea what he actually says until I see it. And you can't trust a press report on a bill like that. You simply have to read the bill and read it carefully. I think there is some basic similarity between Governor Hammond's bill and a previous bill he had in. He put one in. He thought he had agreement between the Attorney General and the Commissioner of Public Safety. And then he found out that he didn't have that agreement. Commissioner of Public Safety was not an agreement, so Governor Hammond pulled the bill back out. It has to be withdrawn. That was in 78. And then my bill was introduced past sessions. And Senator Dankworth has a bill in, as you probably know, too.
Right.
Now, Senator Dankworth's bill in its original form, I believe, did have the support of the peace officers. So I suppose that's the one you're talking about.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Now, the two, I can tell you, two of the principal objections I had to that bill, and one of them was that the, well, I'll take sort of the first one. The first one was it had a no-knock provision in it. Now, the Alaska Constitution guarantees the right of privacy, and of course you go much farther back to the U.S. Constitution and even before that to the Revolutionary War. The old saying in the old days, even before you became a nation, the Englishman's home is his castle, that nobody comes busting into your house in the middle of the night without even knocking at the door. Well, in fact, that is in the bill that was introduced by Dankworth, which the peace officers supported. The second thing that bothered me was the provisions for confiscation of vehicles, that's the boats, planes, whatever, cars, anything else, were so broad that it appeared to me that, let's suppose that I was selling drugs and my wife, completely innocent, that she didn't even know anything about it, right? Got two cars. I drive one, she drives one. Under that bill, they could have confiscated both of them, as I would see it. That was those two objections I can remember right off the top of my head. Now, I haven't really read that bill. You know, it's been 2 years, I guess, since it first came around. So, and maybe some more things I don't remember this minute.
Gail, basically my main objection is that no not to do.
No, I didn't talk to you about it.
So,
okay,
I just
wanted to. And I was curious about, you know, what.
I did bring Senator Dankworth's bill up before the House Hess Committee when I was chairing that committee 2 years ago. And I got a lot of criticism from committee members for even bringing it up. That's what that was, what their opinion of it was. But I did bring it up and did get a hearing. And so,
two years.
Yeah.
So it was, see, the bill was introduced late in the session. Mm-hmm. There was no, from my perspective, there was no way to, at that time to get it going.
How did the Peace Officers Association feel as far as their personal safety in regard to your bill?
I have had no,
comments.
No comments, no. I don't know. My bill was introduced only about, was it 10 days, Peggy, before the session was over? Roughly 10 days before the session was over. No, tonight, we got out May 6th, so it was introduced very late, and I've had no input from this point. Mr. Martin.
Tim, there is one other bill, it's in Bill 101 that I introduced last year, and it's stronger than the House Bill, it's in Bill 65, which Senator Dankworth, but we have been talking, and I have agreed with him in a couple of cases. But at this moment, the no-knock provision is still in there, and in House Bill 101, it has to have no hearings. And there is a strong provision on marijuana, which is evidently, they point out the Senate Bill 65 have let loose on. I know it would be glad to know the Senate that we didn't want to do that, but we accept the bill and release it over. So I guess the strongest one is 101 right now. The Hammond bill, as I was talking to Representative yesterday, not legislative, but the law department, is in my mind very weak in a couple categories. One is the marijuana looseness there, how much can be carried. I understand it's up to a pound now, and there's an opening now for the cocaine possession. And this just worries the heck out of me because, you know, the meth is heroin and the meth is one of the individual ones. So just on those two points, I just don't like to have a bill, although these are just the strongest that would be acceptable to the body of the House. Perhaps he's right, I wouldn't accept it.
Mr. Cotton. Yeah, Terry, the only thing I know about Hammond's bill is what I read in the paper, too, and I saw where he had cocaine and heroin were both still felony, and that's what the state law is now, and the federal law, in fact, is a misdemeanor on first offense on cocaine and felony on heroin, and I believe the governor's bill retains cocaine and heroin in the felony category. So when you say there's an opening on cocaine, I'm not sure what you meant.
By personal possession. what it might be. It might be a felony within public or something like that, but I don't know what that is.
What is that? He's got it other than a felony in his bill? Yeah. You're sure of that?
Well, I didn't lead it, I'm just talking to one of my lawyers and legislative affairs yesterday.
It might be.
I misunderstood what that's what I read in the paper. So it's like Charlie says, you should read the bill instead of reading the newspaper.
You can't trust a very abbreviated newspaper report. It might be of interest to know why this spate of drug bills. And in 1970, the federal government passed a drug law in which they tried to classify drugs according to how dangerous they were, and then to specify both how you would handle them and then what the penalties would be for selling or possession of them. And obviously, the more dangerous the drug was, then the higher the penalty. And after that federal law was passed, there was a model state act drafted. Now, 44 states have adopted some version of that now. Alaska is one of the six states which has not. And our drug laws, put it quite simply, are just out of date. They're antiquated. They do not reflect the latest knowledge that people have about drugs. And so this is, I think, one of the reasons that everybody seems to be sort of coming in with an attempt to do something to make the drug laws up to date, to follow in some way or other the Model Drug Act, Model Act which the 44 states adopted, and which I think Governor Hamlin's previous bill did. I don't know what is this new one, I haven't seen. But that's kind of why this is happening. Because everybody's trying to get into the act now and get us up to date with the rest of the country. Yes, Mr. Parker?
Mr. Chairman, as a drug alcohol therapist, I've seen the results of the so-called minor drugs for quite a few years now. When we're dealing with the drug, cannabis, marijuana, unless we're talking about degrees or the effect of the drug, obviously, the marijuana that's produced and grown in Hawaii has a far greater impact on the central nervous system than the homegrown stuff that we have in Alaska. And so that's sort of like saying, well, it's okay to drink beer, but it's not okay to drink whiskey. But they both contain the same amount of alcohol, and they both do the same damage in the central nervous system. And it was several years, tremendous amount of things. At one time, I thought that marijuana was quite safe. I do not agree with that at all. It's very dangerous.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, just recently we see where physicians and specialists are using marijuana for glaucoma, which interests me because I don't accidentally have that tendency. I hate to be hooked on that. So for one who is very much against drugs, it's developing glaucoma.
Under a physician, I agree.
So as Mr. Parr was saying, as we learn more about it, we have to change our attitude and be more open.
First of all, like I said, I didn't really know that the state of Alaska was running a fashion show with the other states. I thought we were our own state and did our own thing up here, in reference to you saying we have to follow or should follow their rules. Second thing I have to say is, exactly in your bill, where do you put the difference where somebody can have a certain amount of marijuana up to a pound and can't have over a pound? Exactly where do you propose those people that do want to, which there are many of that want to smoke marijuana, exactly where do they plan on getting this from?
You have to remember you may have come in, but
I guess you put the bill in.
Yeah, right? The only one bill, my philosophy is that this is society. If we feel it is not good for anyone to use X drugs, alcohol, things like that, fine. Let's make it nice and clear. This generation does not agree with it. If people on their own want to go out and get bombed and blow their heads off and things like that, on the other hand, I didn't want to waste $10 billion finding some guy that has an ounce or smoking it. No. So I don't believe with that way of putting $10 billion in that money to use it. We do have a responsibility to society as reasonable beings and to the future generation to say we have found this not good for the human being. So as far as I'm concerned, I've been studying this stuff for about 10 years, mainly because I've used
the youth work, and we got involved with it. And my personal judge tell me it's not good. Now, what would the committee decide? What would the legislative body decide? Is democracy in action then?
I agree with you. This is all everybody's own personal opinion. This, in many ways, the marijuana thing, the way the situation is set up, is very much like what Prohibition was to beer drinkers. Very familiar, very similar.
Ms. Reese, your question about, you kind of touched a sore nerve in a way on it, but it's about the fashions. I don't think it's a matter of fashion at all. But they have drug laws which are based on what was known of drugs in the 1930s. Doesn't make much sense. And that, in effect, is what we're trying to get away from. Or 1940s, the latest. We're 20 years behind thereabouts on having drug laws that reflect what we know today about drugs. So it's not a matter of fashion. The other 44 states have simply gotten ahead of us in bringing their laws up to date. The other question, you've asked Mr. Morton, maybe, but I'll respond to it, and if it's of any value. What I tried to do in my bill, and it's not an easy question, you touched a very difficult one, was in the matter of selling drugs to try to graduate the penalties, that a person who was a wholesaler would get the book thrown at him. If he was a simple pusher who maybe supplied his own habit by selling data to his friends, much lower penalty. If he's just a user, you know, has his own use, the least of all. Now, the real question comes in, and it's been a difficult question. We've tried the Drug Enforcement Agency people and the state troopers and everybody else trying to find it, is, you know, where would you put those quantities to separate these three kinds of people? That's the point you touched on in your question, Mr. Morton. When is somebody if somebody has X amount of cocaine, is this what, you know, what does that indicate he is? He's a user, he's a low-level pusher, or he's a wholesaler? At some point, he's bound to be a wholesaler. And as far as I'm concerned, if we had, you know, life sentences mandatory for all wholesalers before drugs, I wouldn't at least follow me. It's simple.
Mr. Chairman. I read something even different into his question. It seems like a kind of a hypocrisy. The way it works is that, the Supreme Court said if you have marijuana in your own home, it's legal. And now getting it there is illegal.
But you grow it there.
Now growing it there is one way, but you have to get the seed there. I don't know if the seeds are illegal. I don't know if that's part of what your question was, too. The guy on the street that sells it to the individual, he's the felon. The guy, the individual on the street that buys it and then walks to his house, I'm not sure what he, I think that it depends on the quantity there. Of course, but if he drives in his car to his house, well, then he's also eligible to go to jail. Once he gets it to his house, well, then it's legal. Well, that's where I don't think there is an answer, and I that's what I read into your question as to where does the guy get it.
So that's the question of economics. You know, I mean, just realizing how much it costs and how much that person has to pay for it. If they buy it in more of a quantity, it costs them less, so they're going to buy it in more of a quantity. So actually, in many ways, you're breeding, what you might say, criminals from people that are...
Well, the police now tell us that, or at least they have told me and, you know, in Juneau that it depends on the manner in which the person, you know, like if he's got a bag of marijuana with a price tag on it, a small bag, and he's out in the street, you know, trying to find a buyer, it doesn't matter how much it is, he's arrested for possession. But if he's up on the top of a mountain in his cabin, and he looks like he's there for the winter, and he's got a barrel of it, well, most likely that's for his personal possession. So it's really not a matter of
a matter of sale.
It's not a matter of how much it is many times. It's a matter of how he's packaging it or how he's banding it about.
Is anyone else on this topic? Okay. Hey, who's next on it? So, gentlemen, are you ready to talk yet?
Okay.
Give us your name, please.
I'm Roger Rendell. I live here at Peter's Creek. I'm also on the faculty of the Criminal Justice Center at the university. And I, first of all, I want to thank you as a committee for coming out here. 2 years ago, there was a lot of public reaction in the Eagle River Tuyac area about crime and criminal-related problems. And I think the legislature was the only one that can be given credit, the only body that can be given credit for having responded to some of the difficulties here. Of course, we went through the vigilante period and so on, but then the citizens were given the opportunity to vote on law enforcement program, and they've taken that obligation on to themselves. So what I'm saying is, I at least, and I think several other people appreciate your efforts, your concern. Well, I'm concerned. I just got back just a couple of hours ago from Fairbanks, where I attended the Governor's Commission on the Administration of Justice meeting. And I'm really concerned with the justice system in Alaska, and I would be hopeful that this committee would be looking at the situation in a little more detail than perhaps has been done in the past. I understand, for example, that there will be requests this next session, as may be the plan for all sessions, that more prosecutors be added, more defense attorneys, possibly more troopers, probably a new level of court, possibly more judges for the current level of court. And my chief concern and interest is in the correctional area, and that I think that if we are going to beef up our personnel in certain areas, we have to have a balanced approach. And too often, corrections is overlooked. It is not a popular thing to pump a great deal of money into correctional operations, because they are, in essence, working with people at the end of the system. However, there's some major difficulties there. We're just today, in the purpose of my trip, going to Fairbanks, was to discuss the final report of the correctional master plan, which has been worked on now for over a 2-year period. I drafted the grant about 2.5 years ago, which got the money to develop that master plan. And we have about $200,000 of state and federal money invested in it. It's a document probably 2.5 inches thick. Fortunately, someone did an executive summary, which is much shorter. But I'm afraid, like a lot of studies in the past, it makes it on some executive desk and gather dust. For the first time, we have a blueprint for action for the next 20-year period in the state. And I'm concerned that it will be paid very little attention after its initial introduction. And I think that would be an extremely wasteful thing. So I'm saying that we need a balanced system, a balanced criminal justice system, with particular concern for corrections. There are community corrections concepts built in the state. We've already passed the bond issue last fall for several new facilities for the state of Alaska, none of which are adding new beds. They are all replacement facilities. Three of our facilities that we're still using in the state of Alaska are federal territorial institutions, which is totally inadequate. I was recently quoted in the media saying to another commission that the master plan consultants in surveying rural Alaska found not one correctional facility that would meet constitutional standards. So nowhere in rural Alaska do we have a constitutional data. So we have to address those sort of problems. Another concern is, though, that we often think of corrections only in terms of institutions, and I think that's also a very serious mistake. We've got to watch out to make sure there's a balance. Well, to get right to the point, there are several recommendations made in the master plan for providing more space at a reasonable cost to the police in our state. One is that we double the capacity of Eagle River, which can easily be done since it was designed to hold 80 more offenders in 2 more housing units than the very start. We can easily and quite cheaply, the most cheaply in fact, double the capacity of the Palmer Adult Center for far less than $1 million. That can be done with volunteer inmate labor. We can add housing units to both the Juneau and Fairbanks facilities, which is badly needed. It won't be long until we're going to have to return our Federal Bureau of Prison inmates from places outside, with a few exceptions. The Governor's Commission policy of a year and a half ago was established that most Alaskans should be retained within state wherever possible. What I'm concerned about, I guess, and hopefully I can share this concern with the committee, is that some of these policy decisions and some of the legal decisions, the statutes that are passed, are not often enough evaluated for their impact. For example, I doubt that anyone here or in very few locations in the state, can tell you what the impact of the sentencing portion of the new criminal code is going to be on the correctional system. There are only two studies I know of, and they differ fairly widely. But since there will be no longer any parole for second, third, and subsequent offenders, it seems to me quite important that we evaluate what that impact is going to have on the bed space. I suggest that it will cost the citizens of the state many, many millions of dollars in the debt. One long-term prison facility, for example, of a secure nature, is probably in the neighborhood of $30 million. You were talking tonight about a drug bill, and I think that it is good for us to get up with crime and with criminals. But we also have to evaluate and estimate the cost of getting tough. If the citizens of the state are informed about the cost of these new laws and statutes and are willing to pay for the services that they have to follow, then I would agree that that's required policy. All I'm saying is that I think there's some red flags down the road, and we aren't working as a system. We have an agency perspective. We have some very good, capable people at the head of these agencies, but they're all protecting their own territory. No one is looking at the total picture. So if the Attorney General wishes to increase his cost, he can get the support and money to do that. The Anchorage Police Department has doubled this last year, its force. And yet there was no beefing up whatsoever of the state correctional system in Anchorage. As a matter of fact, there was a severe shortage of another problem. It was only because of a lawsuit successfully brought by and class action by the inmates of one of the institutions that a policy change cut back the tremendous pressure on the 6th annex. It was a policy change that took care of the overcrowding at the annex, not any statute or law or even legal decision. And that's, I guess, my major message is that policies are being made which can be transferred into costs of millions of dollars. I don't think I'm exaggerating when I throw that figure out. Well, so I would hope that this committee and others will provide some sort of oversight. I was very disappointed. I guess maybe I shouldn't, but I was disappointed that, and I don't know who the legislative representatives are in the governor's commission, but they weren't present. And I've attended many of those meetings, and too often they're not present. The legislature isn't special. Sometimes the commissioners can't be there either. But it's an important commission, and they are potentially a legislative commission, and need to be doing their performing their role. Well, let me get on a couple other things and then I'll stop. Alcohol is a reoccurring problem. It's receiving media attention, legislative attention, executive attention. The master plan also addresses this issue. I think that everyone is frustrated with dealing, especially with the problem driving, that is, the one who is drinking and driving. We seem to have very little hesitation in going to Denmark and studying the fisheries resources. I don't understand why we can't also learn something from the Scandinavians and the social services system. I was over there a year ago on my own and talked with the director generals of the prison and probation systems in Helsinki, Norrköping, Sweden, and Copenhagen. I learned a great deal in 10 days. It seems to me that we should be utilizing that kind of information at the state. Techniques are available, as Paul pointed out earlier. If you can afford it, there are cures available. It might be questionable whether the state has an obligation to provide that treatment. My argument would be that corrections is absolutely the wrong place to put people who are troubled with alcohol and drugs. There is no therapy available from the Division of Corrections, and there never will be. They are not experts in therapy, and we can never expect them to be. All we can do is hope that they will provide security to those who are supposed to remain behind bars, and perhaps some work programs to keep the people used to their lives. I'm suggesting that it's time that the state of Alaska consider a class AAA treatment facility specifically directed toward alcohol treatment, but perhaps including other forms of drug therapy. I think that one facility that would meet statewide needs would be extremely useful. Let's see. As Paul mentioned also the use of the former adult camp as a potential treatment facility, I would suggest that Alcanta is another location that is readily amenable to this sort of treatment concept. There's a facility on top of Open Mountain, 10 miles east of Homer, which is an airport site I studied for a correctional potential. And I'm convinced that that facility could be purchased for something like $2 or $3 million. It would cost another $1 million, probably to bring it up to par. But so for $3 million, you have a facility that could house approximately 160 people, whether they're correctional people or other treatment people. That's a facility that's just going to waste. So I'm saying that there are many sorts of resources we need to inventory, and we need to get busy with right away. I suggested in the Correctional Master Plan that the Office of Alcoholism and the State Office of Drug Abuse are the proper or appropriate agencies which should coordinate therapy or treatment programs statewide. To my knowledge, and I may be unfair, I'm not fully informed here, but to my knowledge, they are really nothing more than pass-through agency and monitoring grants. And I think that's a waste of your money and mine. If we're going to have an office of alcoholism, it ought to be effective, and it ought to be involved, and it ought to be coordinated with the writing sheet. I also think that mental health should be thrown in here, but all of these agencies can coordinate under the Commission of Health and Social Services, the Division of Corrections, to provide all sorts of therapy and treatment. I don't agree with Paul's recidivism factors. I think we're doing much better than the United States. But nevertheless, we can improve on it, whatever the actual figures may be. Well, I think I've probably said enough. There are a couple of diversion projects, Project Prosecutor, which has been going on for about a year, the TASC program, which is a treatment alternative fund, that is being operated in Anchorage, which attempts to divert mainly first offenders who have drug and alcohol problems away from the jail system. My main point, I guess, is that it's completely inappropriate to stick anybody in jail for 3 days. I can understand the desire to punish this individual, and I agree with it, but I think that we can come up with a better environment and a better philosophy for dealing with them than behind bars. I guess that's all my comments.
Let me just ask one point of clarification before we start the questions. Linda, the 3 days you just referred to, are you talking about the 3-day mandatory for Envy? I saw that Commissioner Nixon speaking to the Fairbanks Press Club just yesterday, the day before, said that it was going to cause them real problems in the because of the crowding in the jail. But he also said that he and Mr. Hickey, I guess, Mr. Hickey, who is Al Gross's number one man, I guess number two man in the criminal justice area, said that they're getting a lot of cases in which juries refuse to convict now on Envy cases because of the mandatory 3-day thing. So, what it's worth, that's what they said to the press club in Fairbanks.
Yeah, Roger, you mentioned something that I've heard quite a bit about in the past over and over, and that's that the outside prisoners are going to soon be coming back. Do you know when that's going to be?
It can't be soon. Well, I just heard today that approximately, I believe the 25 have already been brought. 17 have already been brought back. So they're all, and by the way, one of them is Dennis Morgan. And
he used to live up here, or he used to reside up here, mm-hmm. Is this one?
No, Morgan was never, well, I guess he had Morgan was the individual convicted for the murder of a police officer and burglary who was an escape.
Didn't they put him up here and he escaped here?
Right. No, not
more. Oh. Okay. Okay. I didn't mean to bring up old cases. But I just wondered if there was any sort of timetable on that, because I didn't mean to dwell on it either, but if you knew of a specific timetable, I was interested in knowing.
Two things occurred. The legislature, and I don't know, the legislature put a ceiling on the cost of
remember your name is been kicked around quite a bit. You got there the other day. I've given up your report, and according to Mr. Tony's plan, it looks like you will be using that as a guideline for quite some time. However, speaking of myself and the issues I know, as far as this system here, that this is the alcoholic problem, I think I might be actually sort of totally frustrated. And all these black suicides, all these geniuses worldwide, as you know, who have come to Alaska to stop our number one, not national problem, but international problem. And so, you know, when I hear Paul speak, I think, well, you know, wait. But be honest with Paul, the West, I guess, what's next? You know, who's going to bring up the next bag, and I use a great idea, and so on. So I don't hesitate to make, I have too much things to say before. The 3 days in jail, some reports I've heard, some people I know that drink, thank God they're a little more careful. And if it takes a threat, then fine. But I don't know what other answer. I'd love to try this system, you know, I'm always good to learn it. And you mentioned direct cost of opening a new jail and building and foundation and stuff like that. You were worried about how much direct cost it would have, a million here, a couple million there, a million here. Should it also be evaluated by how much we would be saving in human life, how much we would be saving in human time, how much it would be scaling down to a drug problem? How much waste there is in human resources with man and woman not being able to get to their jobs?
Absolutely. I have something that I've been playing with quite a while. I think that we ought to look at developing a full-scale restitution program in the state of Alaska. Restitution traditionally means for people to get the basic.
Walk the street without paying his pocket again, be back in that same situation, and what's that man going to do? He's going to go back out again, rip off again. So another thing was, when you're talking about sending people to jail for 3 days, in many, many instances, the guy will go to jail, being an alcoholic, for 3 days, and it's a school for crime. He'll go in there knowing very little, and he'll come out knowing very much about crime and how to get over it. And you're just breeding more into that person. You're sending him to school in New York City. Another thing is talking about how much it costs. In New York City, there are some institutions that cost $56,000 to house, to institutionalize one juvenile.
Well, I'm sure you all know Randy Phillips, Sam Cotton, Terry Morton, the area. And I'm Charlie Parr, I'm representing Fairbanks. And I'm sorry, Nels Anderson was going to be here, but he's got some sort of back trouble and was with us all day today. He couldn't make it tonight. Let me just give you just very briefly why one of the reasons we're here. In the 5 years I've been in Juneau, and I think probably Sam Cotton can confirm this, judiciary committees very seldom have gotten out of Juneau. And my observation has been almost all the input we ever got down there was from either representatives of state agencies or the court system or attorneys. Never heard from anybody else. And so the reason that the committee is going around the state this year in between sessions is to hopefully get some views from the general public who doesn't fall into one of those three classifications. And we have stretched our committee's, not jurisdiction, but frame of reference a little bit in order to get things pretty well integrated. We're looking at anything law enforcement, the courts, and the corrections. And really, technically, not all those in our jurisdiction, but the committee chairman or both of the other two committees concerned have concurred in what we're doing, and because a lot of these things do, you know, affect one another. What happens in law enforcement affects the courts, what happens in courts affects it, and of course the correction system or the prison system is affected by both of the other two. So we'd happy to listen to anything you have to say on any of these three major areas. We do have, there are some bills that are in, and Rocky Plotnick, our administrative assistant, has brought copies of a number of them, and I'd like you to tell her what they are.
We have Senate Bill 104, which would create an intermediate court of appeals, House Bill 479, which is a bill relating to drugs, House Bill 252, which is about judges and juries, and House Bill 392, which is about domestic violence. And I have plenty of copies, so if you want them, holler.
And the last introduction I make is that Peggy Burke on our left is our staff attorney, and so if there's a legal question, I'll always refer to her. Okay, so who'd like to begin?
No, we're foster parents.
Would you mind giving your names, just so it'll be on the
page? I'm Mr. Shimakonis, and this is Mrs. Shimakonis here. Mm-hmm. We've been taking care of foster kids for the last 6 years or so, and one in particular who's only 18 years old, and he went ahead and he bought a bike up here on Eagle River Road, and of course he's come across the highway here to come to Chugiak, which we live across from the high school. Mm-hmm. So of course the state troopers got him, issued him a citation, so of course we told the boy we couldn't afford a lawyer or anything, so we told him, well, it's right, plead guilty, run before Judge Brewer. And he imposed a sentence of 5 days in jail for the boy he had to spend, and $200 fine. Of course, the sentence was $500 in 30 days, but 25 suspended and $300 suspended, which we thought was kind of rough for an 18-year-old child for first offense.
I thought the point system, too.
Yeah, and then the point system, too, got him. He had to get insurance, cost him $400, because he was working on Elmendorf. His first job he had, and needed transportation. So we thought it was kind of roughish for an 18-year-old native. He's a native boy, incidentally. And, you know, teenagers are kind of hard to bring up. Of course, we took on the responsibility. And for first offense for something like that, we thought it was kind of harsh. And of course, I've got paperwork here to back up. We talked to Judge Brewer. He said, sorry, there's nothing I can do about it.
I'm sorry, so I didn't quite understand. What was it the boy did that
got
arrested?
Oh, he bought a dirt bike
yeah.
in Eagle River here, and he rode across the highway.
To get it home.
To get it home, to Tugel.
That's illegal, right across the highway?
Well, I guess so.
I guess so. It must be.
We didn't have nothing.
That's a dirt bike.
It's a dirt bike. He didn't have no license.
They ride him every day. You see him every day here on the highway. Every day you see him.
See what happened? He went. He has a friend up in Eagle River Valley. And he paid $40 for this bike. So to get it home, he had to ride it home, naturally. Mm. So he came home, and he had no helmet, and he had no license, naturally, because he just bought it. And they got him, because the kid got scared, and he tried to run away from the cop, naturally. Mm. But the cop picked him up and confiscated his bike on top of that.
Yeah,
he never did get
that,
the bike back. And then from there, of course, we had the court case.
Yeah, now, of course, after he got sentenced, of course, I wrote to the governor. And, of course, I wrote to you and asked you about it. And I heard from the governor. In the meantime, Judge Rabinovich got involved, too, in it. So then I wrote another letter, and I got all the documentation here if you want to make copies of it, on what transpired in the meantime. And this was about 8 months ago, so it started. And, of course, we're not, we don't have the money or funds to go ahead and hire a lawyer or something to fight the case. I would have fought it if I had the funds, even though he's only a foster boy. But that's what we think of the boy.
But actually,
he's
really been a good boy, and yeah. I think it's really harsh on him for his first offense.
Yeah,
really.
For an 18-year-old boy.
And it doesn't give the boy a chance. Really.
And it left a bad taste on the cops and, of course, in his mouth, in his mind, which I don't think is right, to spend 5 days in jail for something like a drunken driver gets 3 days only in jail. I got proof right here on the cases that transpired. You get caught drunken driving, 3 days, $100 fine, okay. This boy for riding a dirt bike, 5 days in jail, $200 plus the rest, confiscated his bike. I mean, this to me is...
And then 10 points against him.
Yeah, and then 10
extra.
Points. Oh.
10 points against him and also his
yeah.
Bike confiscated.
Yeah. We believe it was due to he's a native boy.
Yeah.
And Judge Brewer said, I didn't know he was native. I'll show you a picture. Right before the judge. And the judge had the audacity, to me, to write a letter and say he didn't know he was native. The records show he was white. Look at that. Is he a native or isn't he?
Well, I guess they might be able to be
the records show he was a white boy. But just, that's immaterial. But
let me break in just a second. We're just enjoying Representative Pat O'Connell from you know, who's another member of the
judge. Okay, I just had a couple questions. One of them was, I was going to recount one of my own experiences. When before I was ever in the legislature, I used to own a dirt bike, and I rode it across the highway one time here, and I got arrested for it. And I just went in and this was before I was in politics, so I didn't get a break on it or anything. I just went in and talked to the judge and told him about what you said, and I didn't have a record or anything. And they said, okay, we'll let you go. Well, I think I had a $15 fine. So, like, it does vary, anyway, I suppose maybe there are some different circumstances, but I'm sure I was just as guilty as your boy. And secondly, I suppose, since he's already spent the time in jail, part of whatever appeal rights you may have, you know, the effect of that wouldn't be much good because he's already spent the time in jail, right?
Right.
Yeah, the damage has already been done.
Right, so, there, I don't know what, you know, obviously you can't give him his time back, but... I mean, what happens in a case like that, Peggy? Does a person have retain a right to appeal? Or?
Well, I'm a little concerned that whether or not he was informed that he had the right to a court-appointed counsel if he couldn't afford to pay for an attorney.
Yes, we took him down to public
defenders. They said no. You got to get from the judge. But of course, he pleaded guilty. You see, which was right. We told him plead guilty. It's right what he done.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, and then the judge imposed the sentence. That was it, right there.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say, Mr. Chikanis, that Judge Brewer said that he didn't have a choice. That's all he could do, or something.
Well, we went down to see him after.
We went down to see him afterwards and see if we can. Get the sentence license or something. He said, no, I'm sorry, it's out of my hands. He wouldn't do anything. I got the letter.
Oh, after he'd already, okay.
Yeah, after he'd already been sentenced.
Yeah, I misunderstood you. I heard you saying that he didn't have any choice as to what sentence to impose, which I couldn't believe. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wondering, after you went to the public defender's office, they said to see the judge?
Yeah.
Did you see the judge Brewer after that?
No, we went up, his trial was coming up.
Yes.
So we appeared before him, and he said, how do you plead? Of course, we told him, plead guilty, because it's right. What the trooper wrote.
But you had no legal representation back then?
No,
we didn't. Because I went down to the public defender.
I was with them. I went with the boy.
But the public defender said they couldn't accept
no,
it.
No, I went down to the public defenders and I said that he was going to plead guilty because I thought this was what the child was going to do right. Because he was guilty, he was riding a dirt bike. Mm-hmm. He had no business riding it. So he said, well, he didn't need it. If he was going to plead guilty, he didn't need a public defender. So my husband took him to court that day.
It may ask Peggy, doesn't every person need the rule of thumb that most lawyers say if you're guilty or not, you need the representation or you should have it?
Yeah, I mean, I would think that you would want, I would want legal counsel before I pled either way in a particular offense. And generally, what the judge is supposed to do before the person pleads guilty or not guilty, you know, he says that you have the right to an attorney, and if you can't afford an attorney, we'll appoint an attorney for you. Did he give? Did the judge state that before the child?
Well, I'm sure he did. Yes, he did. I'm sure he did. They generally do as a rule. But I did take him to the public defender myself.
Right.
And they said if he was going to plead guilty, he didn't need a public defender.
Mm-hmm.
Which I didn't get because I thought in my eyes he was guilty for riding the bike home. He had no business riding it. And because the child was honest, this is what he got. So it doesn't pay to be honest.
Can they lie? Lie like mad?
Could this be classified as unusual punishment? Does that seem unusual?
Well, I'm curious as to why exactly they confiscated the bike and what the status
because
of that is.
Because he was
right
reckless
now.
Driving.
See, the trooper picked him up for reckless driving. As a matter of fact, he called us. We come to pick him up over there at Plaza 7. So when we got there, Tiny was there picking up the bike. And he was in the trooper's car, he and the other kid was with him.
Mm-hmm.
And of course from there we went to McLaughlin Youth Center, from there we went to the jail.
Because he was over 18, you said.
No, he was 18.
So he was charged with not just
reckless
no tags, he was starting charged with reckless driving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what they charged him with. See, they took him down there and of course we bailed him out. But he spent a couple hours down there waiting for him. And then on top of that, when the judge sentenced him, he gave him credit for one day. So he spent 4 days in addition to that one in jail, which to me, for an 18-year-old boy with those criminals, 5 days in jail for that offense to me is intolerable to me. For first offense for an 18-year-old native boy. Although we're not his parents, but we're his... foster parents, yeah, we think a lot of the boy, and this is why we went to bat for him.
Well, you said now, Mr. McConnell, that you wrote the governor, and you wrote, I believe, Justice...
Rabinowitz. I sent him a copy of this last letter, because he got involved. The governor's staff wrote him and appraised him of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got it here. She can make copies.
Yeah. Well,
of this.
I was wondering that there's a right to a sentence appeal, to appeal.
Yeah. Well, we're dumb actually where it comes to this type of case. We don't know what route to take without getting a lawyer, mm-hmm. and we can't afford a lawyer. Court costs and all this.
Doesn't seem to be any reason for which defender couldn't handle sentence appeals too, right?
No, they handle sentence appeals.
But they won't take your case unless they get the okay from from some judge or somebody higher up. They will not touch it, the public defender.
Well, what happens there, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but what happens there is that the court's the one that has the responsibility of seeing if you can afford a lawyer, not the public defender. And the court, the judge makes that decision. And then if he decides you are, then of course the public defender can take you, but they don't make a decision themselves.
Sure, I can afford a lawyer if I go ahead and mortgage my house.
Mm-hmm.
I got a house that's paid for. Sure, I can afford it.
As a ward of the state, wouldn't the young man be entitled?
No, he's over 18.
He was over 18.
He's over 18 and over your jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But he was a ward of the state as long as he was under 18.
Under 18, yes. But once they become 18,
then the state does not have jurisdiction.
Well, but all I could promise you here is that we would take a look at this and see whether we can find out what might be done, if anything. It's already over with, as Mr. Cotton said, that he's already spent the time in the poultry, so we can't do anything about
that. Well, the damage has been done, but the only reason we come down here is to show you this case. It might help somebody else.
Yeah, it may help some poor native boy in the future. Mm-hmm. That's what we're getting at.
Mr. Chairman, that's why that day, I think it was in April, when we had a committee hearing on minority studies about this case.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that minority study only affected felonies. But maybe this committee can take a look at
misdemeanors
as well.
That's going on, the study's going on right now, by the way, on the misdemeanors, you know.
Okay. So, can I see that picture? Wondering what the judge says, and you said the records show
right
that
there.
The boy
is well?
Records, all the records are there. I kept copies of
we
all of them.
We kept copies of everything.
Yeah.
And he said he didn't know he was a native. And the kid stood right in front of him.
Yeah.
If he don't look like a native, I'm sure he doesn't look like me.
He doesn't to me. I wouldn't know if he was native or white.
No, see, my last letter was about 2 months ago to the governor. And, of course, we said forget it now because we just can't afford to loan or anything. But why we're here actually is to, in the future, to... may go ahead and some poor boy may get...
Well, if you could let us have that file, we can Xerox it and get a copy.
Yeah, because that's our only copy.
I
Xerox copy for the governor and Judge Rabinowitz. I send all that to him.
Well, we can make some copies and get it back to you.
Okay. Yeah. And it may help some boy in the future. Because, you know, teenagers, they're hard to bring up.
It's a typical teenager.
Yeah, they're hard to bring up. And, of course, we contend with all this. And we think he's one of the best boys that... native boys for, and we think a lot of him. He's been with us about 6 years. Yeah, longer than 6 years.
Did you say so that the records show that he was white?
That's what the trooper wrote. You know, when they fill out the ticket on the races, they have to, I think he stated W on there, which meant white or that casual. Judge Brewer's letter's there. If you go on further, you'll find Judge Brewer's letter there to us.
So to show us really that it might not have been a prejudice involved there, because as far as minority problems, it definitely is a problem. I remember the shame myself, like you all tried to.
He
well, we didn't
he
get
at the record. He didn't look at the boy when he was sentenced.
So you contacted me after the fact?
Yeah, after that, yeah. But of course, like you say, the damage is nothing we can do now on it.
Well, it's kind of information, though. The committee is different.
What's the boy doing now, sir?
Well, he's gone back to the States now for a month. He'll be back
he's
in about 2 weeks.
Now,
that's why we're heading towards him.
But he's going to come back.
Pretty settled now.
Yeah, he's pretty well settled. He's a pretty good boy.
Even after this instance, I mean.
But left the bad taste in his mouth. Yeah.
Well, he's been in trouble a couple of times. It's a typical boy, but, you know,
yeah, but not
stand up
actually
for him.
Okay,
well, Dad, I don't consider trouble driving a dirt bike across the highway. Of course, he got scared when he seen the trooper put his lights on, of course. He tried out a lot of them. Anybody would probably, any kid.
Maybe we could go to the next person that would like to speak.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you. We'll follow up on that. Are you?
I'm Paul Faulkner. This is my wife, Jean. We're here testifying before the criminal justice system and your House Bill 392 on domestic violence. In October of 1978, the Abraham decision, Abraham versus State, was handed down from the Supreme Court. And basically, based upon the original Russ decision, this stated that all of the that Abraham was due to total and full treatment within the Division of Corrections for the disease of alcoholism. At that time, I was approached by a member of the university staff and was asked to pursue this. My profession, I've been a correctional officer in the system until I resigned last spring, and I'm a therapist in alcoholism and drug abuse. I was asked by the commissioner if I would present some type of alternative treatment. That was presented to Commissioner Byrne in November of 1978. And subsequent to then, has been sitting someplace within the Division of Corrections and or the Commissioner's office. The proposal was complete. It offered a reformative or rehabilitative method for some 90% of those convicted misdemeanors and felonies within the state. It excluded the DWIs. I didn't pursue those. The current rate of recidivism within the state correctional system today ranges anywhere between 80 and 90%. I had the figures at one time. I don't have them with me tonight. Please quote me someplace within that. Of that amount, 44% are crimes of violence directly related to alcoholism. Of the remainder, recidivism has been rampant not only within the Anchorage area, but also within the Fairbanks and Bush areas. The proposal that was written, someplace along the line, we keep hearing the story, we don't have the money to implement this. As I recall, in 1978, we could have got the entire proposal in and retrained those existing correctional officers, implemented that with a staff of five, for $211,000. Majority of that would have been for a board that would travel from jail to jail. There's been nothing happened to it since. I have no axes to grind because I'm currently not in the Division of Corrections any longer. I'm not even pursuing alcoholism and drug abuse as a therapist. I am concerned definitely because we are involved in the state today in a revolving door syndrome. And the revolving door syndrome has encapsulated not only those who are currently serving time or those who are before the courts, but is also, as you are well aware, showing its ugly head within the driving while intoxicated, and also into domestic violence. I had occasion to do some groups with the batterers, those who batter their wives. And I found in one group of eight, all eight admitted to problem drinking. So I see a definite correlation between the batters and alcoholism. I also will go on record as stating there is no viable treatment center in the state of Alaska today in alcoholism. That alcoholism is a complex but understandable disease for those of us who are therapists in the field. We're dealing with a psychological and physiological approach. We're dealing with genetics. Current research today has indicated that it's definite if your mother and father were alcoholic or problem drinkers, you would be an alcoholic and problem drinker. We see this among our Native population. You see it in a direct 180 degrees change in direction among old cultures such as the Jewish culture, who has a low rate of recidivism, the Italians, who have a low rate of recidivism, because actually their genetics, the genetic carryover has been weeded out through the years. We see it prevalent in the Alaska Native and the South 48 Native. These are things that have not been touched and have not been approached. When I state that we have no viable treatment system in the state today, I do this with some authority. The current Salvation Army treatment program in Anchorage, probably at the end of 18 months, if we found 3 to 5% recoveries, we'd be doggone lucky. I can refer you to a treatment center I recently looked closely at. Down in Seattle, it has an 84% recovery. They're doing this not only treating with the physiological approach, but also the psychological approach. They're using the support services of Alcoholics Anonymous,
and a tremendous amount of therapy. They do this in a 28-day program. And they are researching as long as 2 and 3 and 4 years. And they're finding a tremendous recovery. I think that House Bill 392 could be correlated into an acceptable program, comparable to that that I gave to Commissioner Byrne. And I think, obviously, that you have to have some sort of a control, and I think you're going to ask for the batters to be considered as a felony, or as a misdemeanor. Currently, it's not considered as any crime now, unless the wife pursues it as an assault. I think that we can exercise this well within the confines without costing the state an excessive amount of money. It can be done properly. It can be done under a controlled situation, which the batterers are mandated to the program, or whatever program. And we can take a heavy load off the jail system. Currently, you know, we're looking with the DWIs in the jail systems, totally terribly overlooked, and more to follow, particularly if we didn't get 30 days. So basically, that's where I stand, gentlemen. I'd like you to consider it. I'm open for the questions.
Martin? Thank you, sir. Maybe to ask a couple of technical questions. You talked about the genetic aspect of this problem. In my reading, it seemed like the natives didn't have the problem until a white man came here. And so therefore, it wasn't a genetic thing until we got here. I can't see all of a sudden why they have it. And if it is a genetic thing, how can you suddenly change this within 28 days? In other words, I'm not convinced it's a genetic thing.
I'm sorry if you misunderstood. The native has been drinking alcohol and abusing alcohol approximately 200 years. As compared to the Jew who has been using alcohol with restraint for about approximately 12,000 years.
Well, 220 of Russia.
Somewhere around there. Okay. Now, during that period of time, the disease of alcoholism has, let's compare it almost to tuberculosis. The white man brought TB. Mm-hmm. The white man brought alcohol. And the result is, of course, the native never went out for a drink. He went out for a drug. He does not drink socially, as many people do. He drinks antisocially because he has no other way of knowing this. This is passed on now to the children. The children see mother and dad, and they're drinking, and they think this is a nice thing to do. And so the disease progresses genetically through all the members of the family. Now, I know, as a therapist, I could not guarantee any type of maximum recovery in 28 days. What I am suggesting is that we're approaching alcoholism purely as a psychological problem. And it is not. It is a physiological as well as a psychological problem. The right nutritions, we've changed the natives' nutritional ideas totally. Whereas at one time he had supplements including very high proteins, low carbohydrates, and medium fats. Now he's almost the reverse. As you probably know, sugar reacts in the central nervous system very comparable to alcohol. The pancreas does its job on sugar, transports a lot of that, breaks it down, moves it on over to the liver, and the liver becomes very, very tired. Now, we have a problem of sugar plus alcohol, plus well-meaning people who try to affect a cure by using a drug Valium, and 1 ounce of booze plus 10 milligrams of Valium equals 100 milligrams of Valium. The half-life of Valium is it's ghastly when you look at it. So, in order to arrive at this solution, like we did with TB, and I'm a 32-year Alaskan, and I carry the TB in my body like most of us do who've been up here for a few years. In order to arrive at it, it's a threefold problem. First of all, we have to deal with nutritions, with the alcoholic. I'm referring to the alcoholic and or problem drinker. Secondly, education. And by making those starts, as we did 30, 40 years ago with the tubercular, maybe, we will weed it out. It won't happen in your generation. It won't happen in my generation, obviously. I'm getting a little old. But it will happen if we approach it in the right way.
Well, I can understand your physiological approach to psychological approach, but I can't agree with you on the genetic approach.
I wouldn't
pass, and we usually think of genetic disease like the Down syndrome or things like that as genetic.
I refer you to Dr. James Milam. His book is called The Emergent Concept in Treatment of Alcoholism. He's now in about his 70s. I happen to know Dr. Milam personally. And he has pursued this for over 15 years. One of the authorities in the field of alcoholism today, current director of Alcenas Hospital in Seattle. And Dr. Milam, with his staff of physicians, psychologists, and psychiatrists, definitely, as far as I personally am concerned, and many of my own peers, recognize the genetic problem. I handle this very poorly. Please believe me. I wish Dr. Milam were here because he could explain it the situation. It's so understandable.
Is that the program that's 28 days that you said?
I just had a couple of questions, but I'm a 32. I just decided I've been in Alaska 32 years too. I hope I don't have tuberculosis.
Not lately.
Take a time test. We gave you one in
65. Well, I was still in high school then, so. I take it. I conclude from your comments that you recommend that the state cancel all the existing alcohol rehab programs if they're completely non-effective.
I don't recommend.
Are we wasting our money on most
yes.
of them? Why shouldn't we get rid of them if we're wasting our money on?
3% is better than nothing, sir.
If we got rid of the program, we'd lose that 3%. It seems like 3% would. I mean, 3%. That's nothing. I mean, it seems like they'd fix themselves.
I grant you. We have a very real problem here, and I would suggest this: don't curtail or cut those budgets. As I recall, the Salvation Army received $1,800,000 last spring.
I think we're spending a total of 11 or 12 million on alcohol programs.
And that just for the I happen to live in Anchorage, and of course I know that program very well. No, I'm not suggesting that you curtail or cut these people. I am suggesting that it be done with some viability.
Well, that's what we've always been searching for. People say the same thing you've said for years. They don't work, and you should try something else. And nobody has shown something that's really proven, except for that. To my other question on the Seattle program you refer to, and we hear about the celebrities that go to Long Beach. These are private rather than government programs,
yes.
And so perhaps that's why government isn't able to get into them because of the expense.
Mm-hmm. For example, they accept Blue Cross, Champus, many of the insurance policies. They do not accept Veterans Administration because the Veterans Administration has their own program. And obviously the VIA has some ongoing programs. So they're treating middle class to upper middle class.
What's it cost?
$3,600.
$3,600 per person for the 28-day program?
But that includes a full glucose tolerance test, because we also have gone on record as recognizing the alcoholic. Almost 98% alcoholics test positive on hypoglycemia. They also do a full analysis, including all trace elements. They do a tremendous amount of vitamin therapy. They do a lot of IV, Rikers and dextrose when they go to a primary detox. They take them, they withdraw them from alcohol first, then they will usually find traces of Valium, Librium, or any of the other medications that well-meaning doctors have given the patient. So they find a secondary withdrawal, usually in the second week. And at that time, after they're reasonably assured that the patient is 50 to 75% withdrawn, they will give them a glucose tolerance test. That test removes any doubt at all from the patient's mind that nutrition has been as much a problem with his alcoholism as alcohol itself. You know, if you're constantly pumping a lot of sugar into your system, you're getting the same, that central nervous system does not recognize the difference between the sugar that's generated from alcohol and the sugar that's generated from cane.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Parker, are you a friend of Shadle's in Seattle?
Yes, I am. I'm a friend of it. I'm aware of it.
Okay.
I don't accept it.
I want to make sure because once you said private, I thought so.
No.
There were the King County people down there. I did have a program there on too, 3 weeks. Roughly out on a farm, sort of. And I use it in private, so much.
No, this is Alcinus in Kirkland.
What I didn't quite understand, and I'd like to express it in my own words very baldly and make sure I got the right concept. When you were talking about tying in 392 with the program that you'd given to Dr. Byrne, would you be suggesting something like we have now, I guess, for people who have picked up driving under the influence and they're required to go to driver training, to a driver training course sort of thing, which stresses alcohol prevention? But you'd more or less say that if the cops came and it was a case of domestic violence and the person who was the assailant had a history of alcohol abuse, that then he or she would be required to go to this 28-day program. Is that what you had in mind?
Something quite similar to that, yes.
Mm.
I would definitely try to have them on an outpatient basis.
Mm.
Obviously, if they are in fact intoxicated at the time, there would have to be a detoxing process.
Mm.
There would have to be intensive counseling. It isn't sufficient to for us counselors to work with an alcoholic for an hour out of each day. Father Martin puts it so well, you can lead a horse to water, you can't make him drink, and our job is to make him thirsty. Now, for years we have said alcoholics can only diagnose themselves, and I say this is a crock of hoo, that we have diagnostic tools today that can eliminate the problem drinker from the alcoholic. When I speak of the problem drinker, I'm speaking of the person who can probably drink a fifth of vodka a day and function well and never get in any trouble, never drive his car, never do anything wrong. He's a problem drinker. He is not, in fact, an alcoholic. You tell him what's happening to his liver, and he'll say, "My God," and he'll quit drinking. You tell the same thing to the alcoholic, and he'll say, "My God," and he'll go out and get drunk.
Well, you said preferably on an outpatient basis. Do you think this would work on an outpatient basis? Wouldn't you actually have to get these people off and away from the rest of the world and for that 28-day period?
I'd love it.
But
in all reality, if we're dealing with a person who is a first offender, well, let's take the batter, for example. Or the DWI, we can take either one. If we're dealing with this type of person, they still employ it. If I could induce their employer to go along with them for a 28-day period, you're darn right.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, the real world says we still got to make a living and pay the rent. So I'd opt for outpatient as second,
mm-hmm.
inpatient primary.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? I was interested in one thing you said that, about the fact that these programs are working. The only one that, at least in my 5 years in the legislature, has ever given me any figures, I have no way of knowing how accurate the figures are, but no one's ever given me any was Studio Club. Thank you. Second point I might make, you mentioned the Salvation Army. I got a great big fix of the report of the evaluation of the Salvation Army last session. Must have been 25 pages,
They answer every question except one. And that was, what was their success rate? They answered all kinds of questions about, you know, does the staff does the staff have input into decision making? Are the hallways clean? They did answer every question you could think of except one, and that was whether they were having a success or not. So
it meets the requirements of the NIAAA, National Institute of Alcohol and Alcohol Abuse. In fact, they have to meet a criteria that even demands that if you're in a wheelchair, you have to have certain sized toilets. Mm-hmm. That's all fine. It's all very good. But if a private person like myself even thought of opening some type of an agency without any support, it would take me a year to a year and a half to get authority from the state to accept any patients because of the just of the problems like that. I know I follow.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if you had an opportunity to talk to the city of Anchorage to help people like Bert Hall. Mm-hmm. A lot of the reports that we received came from the investigation that the city of Anchorage did last year, and then they did a rather intensive investigation at the various agencies performing alcoholic services, and they ended up choosing the Salvation Army again. How did they feel about your program?
I presented a program for the DWIs only to the city council, and they said that's beautiful, and they accepted it in total and mass, and referred me to the Salvation Army for funding, and the Salvation Army did not have the funding. They indicated that at that time they were already running $490,000 in the red. So I just dropped it. In fact, I don't need stresses like that. I don't need masses. I have that program that I can submit to this committee. I have the Alan Burns.
You'd like to get a copy of
them. Yeah, I was going to find out where I could get a hold of
them. The commissioner should have them. Also, Campbell should have at least three copies, and I may have one or two copies left around. I'm really burned out on it. I fought it too long. Also, Russ Meekins has one.
One final question on my part, Mr. Parker, and that is that if there were some sort of a tie-in between House Bill 392 and the kind of thing you're talking about, what kind of facility is needed, physical facility? Let's assume that for some of the people there would not, that the inpatient treatment might be possible. Yeah, what kind of facility are we talking about?
Are we talking about divorcing ourselves from what we have currently available?
I'm trying to find out just what it is. In other words, would you need a secure facility? Because obviously this wouldn't be good. And what would be your estimate as to the number of people that we have could be properly handled at one time? That would come into play too.
80 to 100 is the estimate. If it were available, I would take the Palmer Correction to the Palmer Correction Camp. If possible, it's absolutely ideal. Mm-hmm. If not, then if I had the contract, I'd have to contract to Salvation Army or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or at least primary detox. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, let's get back to a thought I had looked before. You mentioned the $220,000 that what you would need was a board to go from one jail to the next.
I'll briefly outline that program. It would constitute a director, a administrative assistant, and a secretary. That would take care of all the necessary paperwork. The board would consist of 5 members appointed either by the commissioner or by the Division of Corrections or by some authority that would have one recovered or recovering alcoholic on the board, preferably someone like Bob Millsap, who we all know is a long-term recovered alcoholic. That board would travel, and that's the cost of the program basically was in the board traveling. It's better to have a traveling board composed of a couple of businessmen, one psychologist,
and the chairman to travel to Ketchikan, Juneau, Eagle River, Fairbanks, Nome, and I get all the correctional assistants on the day. Bethel. They would sit at that time after the inmate had been processed by the therapist within the system, self-correctional officers, had been tested thoroughly, and all of the results had been correlated and given to this board. The board then would offer that inmate the alternative of going through treatment or going back into the system himself. They would point out. They would, that way you see we would not be, how would it be, we wouldn't be endangering the inmate's rights.
You see. Could the parole board do that? Could the parole board do that?
I doubt it. I doubt it. We're dealing with two different types of work. This is a board that's supportive. The parole board may or may not be supportive depending upon the crime. The parole board will be looking at the crime. We're not looking at the crime. We're looking at the treatment. So we wrote this in.